Hi, welcome to the Brown and Happy podcast. In our time together, I will share what it means to be brown and happy. For many of us, everything looks good on paper, but we're still not happy and living fulfilled lives. It's time to change this, and I can help. I'm your host, Dr. Payal Patel Gayal. Hello, lovely ladies. I'm back and I brought a friend again. I love that we can connect and meet new people all the time. And so I have here Tanya Mitra. She is the Remixed Relationship Coach, and I'm going to let her explain a little bit more about herself. And what drew me to Tanya was her energy. I think I've come from, like, in my brain, this very checklisty life. And if you guys don't know what Tanya looks like, but you'll see when I tag her, she has like red hair. She has this beautiful blended family. I just see so much courage in her. And I think that a lot of times we get lost in our own heads and our own minds. And so I think it'd be really fun to have this time to share with her. So Tanya, can you please introduce yourself?
Of course. Well, that was lovely. And thank you, Payal. My name is Tanya, and I am an intercultural couples coach. So I work with couples who are in any iteration of intercultural couples. So whether it be interracial, interethnic, interclass, pretty much all of us are in an intercultural relationship of some sort. We just don't necessarily define it as such. And I work with couples who are struggling, you know, just regular relationship struggles, but we really look at their issues through a cultural lens and really start to dissect and dismantle what the cultural influence is that is affecting their relationship and creating some of those challenges in communication, how they manage conflict, and certainly in how they connect. Because culturally, we're taught to connect very differently depending on, you know, where we grew up, who we grew up around, and what was taught to us, or what I call our cultural conditioning. And so I work with couples to overcome all of that and find a way to use their intersections and all of those differences for good, to bring them closer together rather than driving them further apart.
That's so good. So Tanya, I want to start where all of this kind of began, right? So when I look at my life, I look at, I'm Miss Good Girl, checklist girl, right? Did all the things, check, 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 you know, married, check, doctor, check, kids, check, right? And in my brain, like, I didn't even date someone outside my, now that I'm thinking, outside the brown community, right? You know, variety of brown, but still brown community, right? Because I was so conditioned to think that that's like, you could have any version of brown, pretty much. Like, that was in my head. But I didn't have that even possibility that, oh, I can do this right now in my 40s. I'm like, whoa, that's interesting that there was so many like potential partners out there. And I limited myself to such a small subset. So I just wanted to kind of hear from you, like, how did you get into like being in the space that you're in? Obviously you have some experience in that. So yeah, that'd be fun for everyone to hear.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because I get asked this a lot, obviously, because of the work that I do with intercultural couples. I've been in intercultural relationships for 27 years. So pretty much my entire dating life. I have never actually, except for one guy that I dated when I was 16, and we, our first date was at KFC and we broke up on the platform of a train station. So, you know, that that says a lot. He was Punjabi. He was a really, really attractive Punjabi guy. But that was my one and only like 3 weeks of, you know, 16 dating another South Asian person. Outside of that, you know, I met my first boyfriend at 16 at driving school. And he was just happened to be sitting beside me. We happened to connect. We knew some of the same people. And I didn't think too much about it, you know, like, and I wasn't looking at it like, oh, I'm going to date this guy and he's going to become my boyfriend. We just kind of got along. We connected. We lived a few blocks from each other. And there it was. And what, you know, the important thing I think to say is that for so many of us, dating isn't really a conversation we're having at home, right? Like talking about dating, talking about boyfriends, talking about all of those things. So it was foreign to me in general. So it wasn't like, oh, I'm not allowed to date this particular profile of person. I'm just not supposed to date. So I truly, you know, like I didn't really think too much about it. Like I'm not supposed to talk to boys. That's just like what it is, I'm 16 and not allowed to talk to boys. Like, it's ridiculous. And
Guys, I know
so,
you're nodding your head because my parents said the same stuff to me. Study, get straight A's. You got to focus on your education.
yeah, that's what it is. That's the primary focus. That's the sole purpose, right? And then your extracurriculars, you're allowed to focus on those things too, right? All the other things. The way that this all came to be, I was now dating this guy. He was Jamaican. And I knew that it would be a problem in general. I didn't think too much extra about the Jamaican component until I was really in it. And friends and so on, they're like, "Oh, what do your parents think?" "Well, my parents don't know." "Well, why don't your parents know?" "Well, my parents don't know because I'm not allowed to date, period." They're like, "But, and he's black." And I was like, "Oh yeah, and he's black." And so they found out by finding him in the basement of our house, hiding after they had gone. I'm going to date myself, but you're going to understand this pile. They went to go see Titanic, right? So Titanic is a 3-hour long movie. And I thought I had all this time. And we weren't doing anything. We're just hanging out watching TV as one does, right? Anyway, they came home way earlier than I anticipated. And I was very dumb because I left his shoes upstairs, opened the door, and my dad sees a pair of shoes. He's like, "Who's in my house?" Long story short, they found him in the basement. My dad was very gracious and drove him home. But my parents, that's when everything kind of erupted, right? And so it was many things. It was, "You're hiding all of this. You're not supposed to be dating. You're doing this behind our back. You had someone in the house, and he's black." So it was just all the things kind of came out all at the same time. And that was that's when my sort of battle for true independence started, where I just could not understand why I was being limited or prevented from doing something that I saw my friends doing, or that, was very quote unquote normal and natural for everybody else. And, that's truly when my fight started for me to be able to express myself as the person that I am.
That's so good. I was laughing my head off on this side because I could just imagine that scene go down. And also, I've been told the same stories. The only difference is like I was like bought into it. And with all the exposure in like, I think I told you this before when we were talking, we first met, was like, I just had this idea of like the way Bollywood goes, and I'm gonna go to Europe, I'm gonna meet my, what is it? Raj or Rahul or what was it, Raj? That's like, because I'm dating myself too, so I'm just showing you guys. I had this idea in my head, but like moving forward, like I kind of just had my blinders on, and I think that now I find myself being like, okay, one, questioning why I did that, and also I think the part that I, initially wasn't this way was like first judging myself for being that way. I'm like, oh, why couldn't I be like Tanya? Why couldn't I have did, but at the same time, like that's all I knew. I didn't know any
Yeah,
different.
it's what most of us know, right? Like, and I didn't know that I would be the person to fight against it, because I too, up until that point, had done all the checklists. However, I will say, I did have a separate sort of entire component to my life that my parents didn't know about. And the interesting thing, and something that I say to them so often, even now, is like, "You raised me to be this way. You raised me to be independent, make my own choices. You just wanted me to do that within the scope of where you wanted me to do that, right? Make the right choices with education, make the right choices with friends, make the right choices around drugs, make the, but you raised me to be this way. My parents wanted me to travel. They sent me traveling by myself. At the age of 14, I flew to Africa by myself. Like, so you raised me to be this person. How come it's now limited when it comes to something you don't approve of, or something that's not on your checklist? But maybe it's on my checklist. You know what I mean? And so it's like you don't always know that you're fighting the fight when you're fighting it. And when I was fighting it, it was incredibly painful. It was an incredibly painful fight to fight. And it was an incredibly like lonely and isolating fight to fight, because this is back in the 90s and there was no social media, there was no internet like the way it is now. So there wasn't a lot of resource, there wasn't a lot of community around it. And certainly in the, my parents are Bengali, in the Bengali community, nah, this wasn't happening, right? Interracial meant white. Interracial certainly was never supposed to mean black. And then there was interfaith Muslim, right? So as Hindu people, we're like, oh, but you should not marry a Muslim. And it just never, none of that ever made sense to me. I was like, well, what happened to us just being people and connecting with people on a human level? And that's, that was sort of the component of my life that my parents didn't have a lot of exposure to, because I really loved to connect to different types of people and learn from them. And when you incite a travel bug in somebody, that's part of it. You start to learn about cultures and people and have experiences. And I'm like, okay, well, that's all great until it becomes dating, And so yeah, like I think, I didn't know I was fighting it until I was really in it. And the fight itself was really painful. So I can understand why a lot of people don't choose to go that route.
The path of least resistance.
For sure. Yeah.
For sure. And that is so lonely, right? Like the way that you like talked about, because that felt lonely as teenagers. I felt very alone in my life and the way that I was raised, right? But also what I talk to a lot of my clients about is like some of the loneliest people right now are in marriages too.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Absolutely. It's an epidemic of being partnered and feeling isolated, feeling lonely, feeling like you don't have companionship, that feeling like you don't have partnership. You're just coexisting, right? And people have redefined, I think, marriage and partnership in a way that has normalized that for them so that they can keep moving forward, or they can be in it, right? They can sustain it. But that's not what marriage really is, or that's not what partnership really is, right? That's certainly not what partnership is. And I don't think that's what marriage was intended to be. So, I think we have to also start to redefine what we want and start to become aware of what we want. And I think a lot of us as South Asian women in particular, we were never asked to search internally for what we want. We were always so busy doing what everybody else wanted us to do and fit, check the boxes that everybody else had for us. So we get into these relationships, these marriages, and we don't really know who we are. Often our partner doesn't, if you're with a South Asian man, often they don't know who they are. And so where do you find the happiness, right? Where do you find that happy place when you're both still searching and you're both sort of living for external, like to satisfy the external pressure rather than, the ability to look internally. It's a hard place to be.
Like the checklist phenomenon, that's what I call it, right? Like
Yeah.
career-wise, right? Everyone's doing that. They're doing that with their family. They're doing that with their hobbies or whatever, right? Like what does your house look like? What car do you like? What social circle are you in? Like all of those things are what kind of drives us during the family growing phase. I just want to say that, right? Like the 20s, the 30s. And I think what I'm finding now, and so Tanya and I are close in age,
Yes.
that like in our 40s, like I'm finding a lot of people and a lot of women being like, I don't even recognize myself. I don't recognize my life. I don't even know who I am. Because like
Yes.
sometimes we're working together and I'm like, what do you want? They're like, I don't even know. I've never been asked that question and I've never answered that question honestly.
Yep. Yep.
Right. So
Yep.
our first step really is to be like, well, one, not make it a problem that you haven't, answered that question, because we also are a little perfectionist in this personal development space. And so like be like, it's okay. It's okay for 4 decades that it didn't, this is not how things went. And also you have the rest of your life left to live it the way you want. And I
Yeah.
think there's a lot of hush-hush culture, like in, in our communities where people are doing amazing things, people are growing, but people don't talk about the stuff that actually happened. And I think that's why I was drawn to you, because I'm kind of doing the same thing in a different kind of way, where we're just like, we're talking about the stuff that you would never want the aunties to know.
Yeah, I want the aunties to know all of it. Like, I want the aunties to know every piece of it. That's why I'm such an open book now, because I am okay with being the example of, what they think not to do that actually works, because my life works. You know what I mean? Since that time, I have, very unapologetically lived into the things that I have wanted for me. And I don't require approval from pretty much anybody for it. And it's just such a sense of internal freedom that really no amount of external success, the things that we usually measure, status, job, money, like the things that you were saying, house, car, all those things, title, none of that stuff can replace this sense of internal freedom. From this place, I can create more of that because I'm doing it in a way that actually is aligned with who I am and where I want to be, who I want to be. But yeah, it's not an easy process to get here. There's a lot of self-challenge that you have to go through. There's a lot of external challenge that you have to go through. But there's also, it's a choice every day. Like you just said, you have the rest of your life, but you can make that choice right now and do one thing for yourself today. Do one thing that is true to you today, right? Whether that's ordering the thing that you actually want to eat at the restaurant. You know what I mean? Not the thing that you think you're supposed to eat because you're supposed to lose 5 pounds or whatever, like whatever context we're looking at it in, there's always a should and an actual want, right? Like we need to stop living by the shoulds, especially us as South Asian women, as people who have been so conditioned to live by the shoulds, letting some of that go is just such a liberating experience. Like nobody can tell me what I should or should not do, whether that comes to my life, my business, any aspect of me, what my children, until you've lived in my shoes and until you have lived my story, you don't actually have perspective. And that's another thing that I share with my clients as well. A lot of my clients, all of my clients are in intercultural relationships, but there's a lot of external pressure from parents, extended family, and there is a lot of expectation, of what they should and should not do. And a lot of, there's this controlling that a lot of the parents want to do. And my clients really have a hard time with that because they want to live this autonomous, sovereign life, and they want to have the ability to create their own family in their own context. But there's all of this stuff coming at them, and they don't know how to fend that off. They don't know how to manage, all of that. It's a hard thing. It's a really, really hard thing.
The reason I find the older generations wanting to continue to have some control or say over their adult children is because, one, they think it's a reflection of them, their parenting,
Absolutely,
right?
yeah.
They give a lot of, whatever. I'm gonna have to keep this so it's not like I can't say explicit, but you understand what I'm saying. They care what other people think. And I want to say this because I have to keep telling my mom about this a lot. It's like, you guys need to get a life. Right? And I say this in some ways, and she doesn't listen to my podcast, so I don't really care. But it's like this micromanaging. It's like if you felt like you had a full life and you did stuff for yourself, you wouldn't have any time to ask, what are your kids eating for dinner? Like, what about this? What about that? And it's like, yeah, I think that part of it is like, we want to be respectful to our family because respect is a core value in our culture.
For sure.
Also, we are trying to learn to live in this fusion kind of culture, right? Like the Asian American, whatever version you are. Like whatever religion combination, whatever it is. And I think a lot of times our generation carries a burden of this like heaviness, and I'm great. I love when I see like the young millennials, the Gen Zs, everyone. I'm like, oh my God, I love that you guys are living your best lives. I love that you guys pick career paths. Obviously, I went to medicine. I like what I did. But like I can see people who are miserable,
Oh yeah. That's another area that, just is it's really heartbreaking sometimes to see people get caught up. And that's what, you were speaking to earlier where, you wake up and you're 40 something and you're like, shit, sorry. What happened? How did I get here? And it has to do with career and life partner and choices that they've made. and you know who they are, they don't even often know. And that's, you know, that's another thing. And I think by virtue for me personally of having had to search for my independence so early in my life, traditional career path, like, just didn't, I knew what I wanted to do since I was 8 years old. I knew that I wanted to work in fashion since I was 8 years old. And my parents were actually very supportive of the, of my interest in it. Not, they didn't, I don't think, ever think it was going to become a career, but my mom would buy me Vogue magazine and all the, you know, Marie Claire and Teen Vogue and all that stuff at 8 years old. Like, she understood that I was really into it. My mom also was very into hair and makeup and things like that. So she kind of got it, right? And so that really piqued my interest. And I knew from when I was 8 years old that I wanted to work in fashion. I had no idea how I was going to do it. And I didn't know that it was like a career path. I just knew I wanted to be in this world. And so, but still, you know, I went to business school, as a good Indian girl does, right? So I still felt the need to fulfill the, you know, that box, right? Like, I still felt the need to do the thing the right way. Yeah. And so I did do that, but simultaneously, as I was about to graduate, with my business degree, I applied to fashion school in New York, to FIT, Fashion Institute of Technology, for those of you who don't know, top fashion school, in one of the top fashion schools in the world. I got in, I found an apartment, and then I told my parents mm-hmm. that I was going to go. Interestingly, twist of events, turn of events, my mom is the one who got me my first internship at Giorgio Armani. So look how things work out, right? So my mom's colleague's best friend, so a good close colleague friend of my mom, his best friend was, you know, an executive at Armani and knew that I was then going to go to FIT and offered me an internship. And that internship turned into my job. And that job led me to an entire 20-year career in luxury fashion, the exact thing that I wanted to do. And, you know, again, had I not been, it had the courage or just the vision, like the need for self-expression in the way that I had it, I would never have been able to pursue something like that back then. And then now we see Indian people in fashion all the time. It's like a common thing. But in 1998, that was, or, you know, and I moved to New York in 2002, like, that wasn't a thing. South Asian young girls were not working in fashion and certainly not in a career. So, you know, I've been very fortunate, but I see so many people like just not able to do the things that they truly, truly want to do. And, but it's never too late. It's never, ever too late.
That's what I like to talk to, like, you know, my clients, and I like to talk to my future clients about this work, right? It's like, just because you've done something a certain way doesn't mean that you have to keep doing it. And it's almost like, I just coached on this last week. It's almost as if, like, you need to give yourself permission to reassess and reevaluate a choice that you made maybe 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years ago. You know, it's okay, right? Even like when people are in like relationships and marriages and all the things, right? Like, you get to reassess it. Is your relationship with your partner not something that brings you joy anymore, right? Like, and is your relationship with your parent that way? Is your relationship with your child that way? We don't talk about that a lot. I mean, I talk a lot.
We don't. It's okay if it's not. It's so important to be able to admit when it's not, right? It's so important to be able to admit that this isn't fulfilling me. This isn't satisfying me, because it's only then that we can do something about it. If we're not able to admit it, then where do we start with the change? Like, we just, that's where the stuckness comes in, which I'm sure you see all the time, right? I see it too, where it's like, okay, well, if we don't even know what it is that we want, if we don't believe what we want is possible, if we can't even admit it and say it out loud, I see this in my couples all the time, where it's like, well, we don't even want to admit that we're having problems. Yeah. Well, dude, how are we going to change anything?
I think there's a fear of, oh, if I if I acknowledge and admit it, then I have to do something, and that makes me uncomfortable to do something. And so I rather not see or do anything. And I think some of you guys, I just want to say to talk about, some of you guys are hesitant to reach out to get support, get help, because you think that you have to like burn everything down and start over. I think that's the biggest lie. And I try to reemphasize this to everyone. It's like, no one needs to know. Nothing has to change when you start loving and working on yourself, right? Yeah. Then you get to decide, oh, would I like to change something in my life? Yeah, maybe. But the first thing that we talk about and we work with you on is like the way that you are talking to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to be able to tell yourself the truth first, right? Like that is so crucial to the process. If we can't even tell ourselves the truth, which so many of us cannot, right? We don't know how to mine within our own being for our own truth because we face discomfort when we do it. And so we run away. And then we tell ourselves a story that, you know, no, this is okay. No, this is actually what we want. No, you know, it's going to be fine. And we convince ourselves of our thing, but our body knows, our mind knows, you know, our spirit knows that that's not the thing, because that's where you start to see the things not aligning in your life. But once you really start to, you know, admit, okay, maybe I'm not happy. Maybe I'm not happy in this partnership anymore. Maybe my kids do drive me crazy and I don't, you know how to control them. Or, you know, maybe I don't like my job and this career isn't for me. It isn't, you know, fulfilling me in the way that I thought it would, or I hoped it would. Because a lot of it is just hope, what I call a hoping strategy, right? We hope that it's going to work out. We hope, but we're not basing it on our truth. We're just basing it on somebody else's truth. So yeah, we should hope, because if it's not based on our own truth, then the likelihood of it really panning out in a way that fulfills you, fills you up, makes you, and is sustainable, is slim to none. So, you know, being able to really start with the truth internally is such an important first step.
And I think that what I find most people like not willing to do that is just like not willing to feel uncomfortable. And what most of us do is, because we don't want to feel uncomfortable, one, we won't even look at it, but also we like find methods or ways to escape our emotion, right? And absolutely. So this could be like overwork, over deliver at home, right? Preparing, all that stuff, overeat, over drink, like over exercise. That one is like, well, at least that's a good one, you know?
Oh my God. I know so many people who over-exercise. Oh my goodness. And because you can get away with it, like you said, right? Because it is seen as positive in society to take care of your body. But when you're taking care of it to escape something else, you're not really taking care of it.
That's like the overwork thing, you know, but except unless you're a woman, then it's a problem.
Right.
But like, this is like this double standard and the patriarchy, we can go on forever. This is so good. I want the audience to be able to hear a little bit about like what you do and like how you work with people. Cause I think that, you know, like literally we can do like a series of four different episodes, like, cause Tanya and I can go on with all the different aspects of like, you know, people we work with, but can you tell us a little bit about that, Tanya?
Sure. So I work with couples, like I said, in any iteration of intercultural. Most of my couples are interracial, interfaith. Some of them are just interethnic. So I work with them in a really, what I think is a really unique model, where I do a hybrid of individual and couple sessions with them. I find that really, really effective, because they're able to work, especially when you're in an intercultural, you know, situation where you're really able to work out your own stuff, your own belief systems, like, you know, get clarity on your own things and then bring that clarity to the couple session, rather than trying to sit there and figure out what's going on while two of you are not in a great place, right? So this really gives the individual space, time, and just, you know, the ability to work on what's going on with them in the context of their relationship. So we do that for 3 months. I hold my clients in a 6-month container. So my program is called Relationship Renaissance. So we really do rebirth the relationship. And we do that, you know, in the first 3 months by looking at our inner worlds. So we are looking at the inner world of both partners. We're learning about each other's inner worlds. We're really exploring what makes you you, right? What makes me me? What makes you you? And where are those, where are the strengths and where are the challenges? And how are those challenges showing up for us? Is it in communication, the way we talk to each other? Is it in our expectations of each other, right? Especially when it comes to intercultural stuff, there's a lot of confusion sometimes about roles, gender roles, responsibilities, who should be paying more, who should be parenting, who should be picking up and dropping, like so many different things, who should be making more, what happens when one makes more, what happens if the woman makes more, what happens, you know, all of these types of things. And then we shift into using those intersections and understanding, okay, where are the, you know, these are our intersections. These are all of the things that make us us. Now we have more empathy and understanding for each other's stories, mm-hmm. right? So we understand, okay, that's why you do this thing. Oh, you're, because, you know, like I have a client right now who, a couple right now, where the wife was raised in a divorced family environment where she had a great relationship with her mother, was pitted against her father, found out that her mother had been lying to her all that time, then found out the truth, and then now is closer to her father. So there's a lot of, you know, abandonment stuff, trust stuff, and the partner who, so she is Black Caribbean, they're in the UK, and he is Pakistani Muslim, grew up in a house with extended family and lots of siblings, and the parents are together and the mother just cooks and cleans and doesn't do anything outside, never worked a day in her life, you know, outside the home. That's lots of work inside the home. But, you know, he had never seen any other sort of iteration of a mother figure. So imagine the clash in what even family means.
Right.
So family for her means the two of them. Family for him means not until we have children.
Yeah.
You know, so that in itself can create such a disconnect in the relationship. So we use all of that information and we start to form interventions that work for that particular couple, depending on their intersections. Like, what are our challenges? What are our differences? And how do we then start to weave that stuff together? Because my philosophy is we don't always have to agree. And we don't, you know, we can agree to disagree. We can have different sets of beliefs. We can have different values. We can have different ways of looking at this thing, as long as we understand where the other person stands on it. And we can agree that we can have empathy for their perspective, as long as it's not hurting us, right? There's a way to find compromise in all of it, but we have to understand first the root, you know, of where all of it is coming from. So then we move from there into 3 months of couples only sessions. So now they've done a lot of work individually and together for 3 months. And then we move into a 3 months of implementation, right? So we're using the interventions that we've learned. We have all this knowledge about each other. Now let's start implementing, because what people come and do in the session is very different than what they'd come and do in real life, right? So we do a lot of practical implementation. Sorry if you hear my dog barking.
That's okay.
practical implementation of the interventions, because couples actually have a really, really high rate of relapse. A lot of times couples will go into a therapy situation and not be able to actually execute on what they've learned. So for me, it's really important that my couples learn how to actually implement these tools and techniques into their lives, because I can't be there at 3 a.m. when they're having a fight, right? Like they need to work that out.
I think like being able to have time to see what obstacles come up in real time is so important. And that's why, you know, I work with people over time too. Like I used to do like, you know, we do like 3 months, we got this, whatever, right? And the reality was like, no, it took 4 decades to come up with this. So like longer. And so I've had people with me. So I work just with women
And I have people with me who I've known for years and I work with them for years, right? But like just having that available to you and just be like, you know, that thing that we like talked about, like, well, this thing happened and I didn't react this way. And I'm just like, I'm questioning like why. And I'm like, okay, cool. Like, let's talk about it. This is so good. Thank you so much for sharing. I'm going to share all her info in the show notes. And then I'm going to link her on my social media. But Tanya, thank you. Thank you so much.
You're so very welcome. Thanks for having me. This was fun. It's always fun to chat about, you know, real life stuff. This is all so real and it's so important for us to hear each other's stories, right? They're all so vastly different and one is not better than the other. It's really just about, you know, again, going back to doing what's right for you. And when we are able to do that in a way that's really the truth for us, really in alignment with who we are, who we want to be, the whole world can open up, right? Like the entire perspective of life changes and the choices you make can become so different just from that place of truth.
So good. I love it. Thank you. You're probably going to hear more from her in the future. We'll come up with like another time. But guys, I hope this was helpful. If you have any questions, if you have any thoughts, like we want to hear from you. You have any stories to share, whatever comes up for you, like, we got you, right? We love what we do, right? This is like a second career for both of us.
Yeah.
And honestly, I really, at least for me, I feel like, you know, I was able to get clarity and reassess and like start a life that I love so much every day. Anyways, have a lovely day, guys.
Hey, if you're finally ready to start being happy, I invite you to join my list. This is where you'll have access to all my workshops, coaching, and pearls. Just head to my website, www.payalghail.com. That's PayalGhail, and join my list. I can't wait to meet you.